what I thought was there were a number of topics in there that I thought were very widely applicable. Now, I know a lot of the folks you interview were business owners, but a lot of the things that made them successful in their own business can be very easily applied to people who are building careers, perhaps working for other companies. And I wanted to cover probably two or three areas in particular that I thought were most relevant. I think you had a section around the importance of building a personal brand. We'll make sure you want to cover that, as well as the importance of the ability to sell, either to sell oneself, you know, in a more traditional like interview context, as well as selling an idea, a product, or a service. So I want to make sure we cover those two things. But before we dive into that, I just wanted to ask you very quickly, of all the very impressive people you interviewed for the book, I'm curious, was there any one or two takeaways that really surprised you about, you know, any common themes around what people said in terms of what made them successful over their careers?
The one surprise was not in itself surprising, but what was surprising was how incredibly common and ubiquitous it was almost everyone had some kind of background in sales very early on in their experience, and often not very glamorous sales. You know, encyclopedia salesmen, you know, before the age of Wikipedia, you know, door-to-door knife selling. I mean, not the kind of stuff that sounds very fun, but almost everyone, not everyone, but almost everyone learned sales very early on. I mean, that's not in and of itself surprising that sales would lead to success, but just the ubiquity of it was kind of relentless as I just kept interviewing one person after the next and they started talking about sales.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because I my first business, if you call it a business barely, was when I was 9 and I started selling shoes, mostly to like neighbors and friends and family. And then later one of my first jobs was doing cold calling, did advertising sales, and I also did cold calling on behalf of Merrill Lynch as part of an internship where I essentially worked for free in exchange for getting some experience.
Yes.
So it's interesting you mentioned that.
And, you know, a lot of them said, you know, it's just important to get a lot of sales experience under your belt. And I'm not certain that I fully agree with that take on it. I'm actually not sure they're interpreting their own experience correctly. I actually think a better interpretation of it came from you, and I talk a lot about what I've learned from sales from you in the book. There's quite a long section you know, detailing what I learned from you about sales, which is that there is a kind of sleazy, low-integrity, pushy way to do sales, which is most of the sales we experience and most of what we associate with the word sales, which is why a lot of people are kind of scared of sales. But what I learned from you is actually that there's a more high-integrity way that you don't have to pinch your nose to do. And I think that that's the kind of sales experience you want to be having. I mean, I actually had about 6 months of experience at one point doing corporate sales in a corporate culture where there was a very pushy, aggressive kind of sales was encouraged, and I'm not certain that experience helped me at all. So there is
a
distinction
there.
Yeah.
Useful distinction to point out. And I'll mention, because a lot of the folks I know on this call are either in the management consulting industry or aspire to be. And I think you're right. There very much is sales in every industry. And in consulting, it's a much softer sell than you would say find on a used car lot, but there's a very subtle way to do it, but it is selling nonetheless, and its role really can't be underestimated. You know, it's interesting. I one of the premises of your book, I think, was in the introduction, was the value of formal education versus all the stuff you learn afterwards. I always thought it was very interesting because I have a few law firms that are clients. I personally worked in consulting for a number of years. And what's interesting is in the sort of, very professional degrees of, the JD, the MD, the PhD, the MBA and whatnot, they're considered, fairly white-collar roles, very well-respected roles. And I think a lot of people have this perception that sales is more of the blue collar, the thing you want to try to avoid. And so I see that perception, you know, quite a bit. And what I found was interesting was that if you look at, you know, law firms, you start off as an attorney, you get promoted, and you end up as a salesperson.
Yeah.
That's the role. That's called a partner.
Yeah.
Same with an investment bank and whatnot.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you've pointed to here is a distinction between what you need to get in the door of a certain career and what you need to excel. And they're very different things. It's sort of weird to think about. You'd think that they would have the thing that gets you in the door be very related to the thing that gets you to excel once you're through the door. But for some reason, maybe you have some insight, they don't tend to set it up that way.
I'm not sure why they don't, but you know, the attorneys I speak to that are my clients, they say, you know, they never taught us how to get a client.
Right.
You know, or keep a client
in
law school. You learn about constitutional law and all of these different cases, but how to actually, like, sit face-to-face across from a client and connect with them and communicate and convince them of an idea. In medical school, same thing. It's, you know, if you go into practice for yourself, they don't teach you how to get a patient. By the way, the big thing these days is getting sued. And there's not a lot of training around how not to get sued. Apparently, it's actually quite easy to avoid getting sued.
Yeah.
But it's an interpersonal skill, not a medical skill.
Exactly. So in your formal education, my assumption is that most of the people on the call here are highly educated and got, you know, the kind of training that would allow them to get a prestigious consulting job or job in some kind of management, corporate management. The skills that you learn that get you in the door tend to be what we might call book smarts. Test-taking skills, studying, your ability to absorb information, organize it, present it back effectively, those kind of skills. And part of the reason is that those are fairly easy to test, whereas the soft skills are harder to evaluate. I mean, you really only evaluate them when the only real way to evaluate sales skills is to go out and sell and see if you close the deal. And so you can only do that by definition in the real world, because ultimately, if you don't close the deal, it wasn't a successful sale.
Yeah, very fair point. Let's circle back to the topic I really wanted to focus on, and maybe we can come back to sales later.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about personal branding. You know, this is something that, you know, I was very impressed with yourself, actually, in terms of how much focus you put on in your own career. And, you know, in part inspired by you, I decided to put a lot of a focus on it myself starting about 3 years ago.
Thank you.
I've been
hounding on you a little bit over the years.
Yes, you have been. Very persistent, let's say.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what have you learned from the others that you've interviewed around the value of a personal brand? And if you can share sort of both your philosophy as well as what you've learned from the others, would be very, appropriate.
I'll start with what I learned from my interviewees, and then I'll go to my own experience. So for the callers out there, in case you don't know, the basic focus of the book was that I interviewed people who did not complete college, either didn't go or they dropped out, and then became very successful financially, millionaires or billionaires, self-made. And my purpose to interview that population was not necessarily to bash formal education. I have a college degree, so I'd be kind of a hypocrite to do that. But it was to get kind of the best test case of people who just focused on street smart and practical skills and didn't get any academic education and see where they went in life. And so I have this one chapter called Building the Brand of You, and the subtitle is To Hell with Resumes. Maybe a little extreme, but I wanted to be provocative. And in that chapter, I interviewed numerous people who did not complete college, and the focus of their effort was building a recognizable brand as a personality online. And what I found with these people is that if they have a very recognizable brand, their formal credentials, the type of stuff you would put on a resume, almost didn't matter to their career success. So I'll give you an example. Someone I interviewed is Robert Scoble. He's widely considered one of the tech blogger, one of the top tech bloggers, and was really one of the earliest bloggers ever, starting, you know, when in the early 2000s. So he has an incredible brand that he's built over many, many years through just blogging, and putting out content and just having tons and tons of content, good, really good content to his name if you search for him. So he's built that, and he works, he has a crazy job. I mean, he's employed. He's not an entrepreneur, but he works for Rackspace, which is one of the top web hosts. And he's basically, I don't even know what the position would be called. He's sort of like their spokesperson in Silicon Valley. And the company is based in Austin, I believe, or maybe Dallas. And he basically just goes to events in Silicon Valley and represents, he talks to people as a representative of Rackspace, but at very high level. So when I interviewed him, he was about to get on a plane to go to the Davos conference. This was in earlier this year. And I asked him, oh, did they send you there? You know, did you get an assignment to go there? And he said, no, I just thought it would be useful, you know, some people to meet there. And, you know, I'll tell them I'm there once I'm there, and I'll send them the expense reports. So needless to say, that's a highly unusual relationship to corporate employment. And I believe the reason he has that kind of dream job, if you will, where he basically writes his own ticket in terms of how he's going to add value and what kind of leadership he's going to exercise, is because he was a known quantity before he went to get this job. So he wasn't just, you know, number 346 in the stack of 500 resumes asking for the one job out of those 500 resumes. He was someone, they wanted him. And the reason they wanted him was because he was his name was known. He had a name for himself, primarily built over the internet through putting out a lot of content under his name.
Well, for those who are not familiar with that particular industry, Roberts was extremely, extremely high profile in Silicon Valley. All the startups in Silicon Valley, they typically try to accomplish three things in life. One is raise capital from venture capitalists. Two is to, you know, build a business. And third on the list is to get people like Robert School to notice them, to write about them. So he's extremely, extremely influential. There's about three or four folks in the Valley that are that influential, and he is certainly one of them.
Right.
I heard this phrase. I can't remember if I read it from your book or it was just in one of our conversations. But it was something, or maybe this was in one of the many posts and articles I've seen written sort of about you or around you. The thought was, you know, you are what you publish. So the idea is your personal brand is, for everyone who's on the call, here's how you figure out what your personal brand is. Go to Google, type in your name, hit return. What you see on the next page, that's the personal brand, right?
Yeah.
So for a lot of people, there's nothing. Sometimes it's like stuff you don't want on there.
Yeah.
But if you can talk a little bit about sort of your thoughts on that, and how do people, what's the mindset you have to build a personal brand, and how does one even get started in something like that?
Great. So the word brand probably has more fluff and BS written about it than any other word in the business lexicon that I can think of. It almost gets to a mystical point. You read these books and they sound like some kind of mystical guru, you know, talking about branding you. And there's all kinds of hucksters out there that you can pay to quote unquote brand you. So they have an interest in making it very complicated. So what I want to do right now is cut through that BS. I will give you a one sentence definition of brand right here. Your brand is what people think of when they hear your name. Your brand is what people think of when they hear your name. So if people you know, hear your name, and this could be either online or like when they're Googling you, or you know, when your name comes up in conversation. So you know, just think about what are people talking about when your name comes up in conversation. If it's, you know, that you're you know, manipulative or a bad communicator, or you know, or have temperament problems, or disorganized, if that's the kind of thing that gets talked about when your name comes up, that's your personal brand. If you know, and you can think of positive examples, obviously. And so it's a general tenor of conversation that people have when they have your brand. So I didn't go out trying to build a specific brand a priori, like thinking, okay, this is the brand I want. I kind of listened to how I was being talked about very carefully, and I noticed that, I mean, I heard the good stuff. Maybe there's bad stuff I haven't heard. But when I heard things positive being talked about me, they tended to focus on me being a connector. Is this something I naturally do? Is I connect people? It's almost like giving birth to a new friendship when you just shoot an email that connects two people. That can impact both of their lives for the rest of their life. So it's something I take a lot of pleasure in. It's something I do a lot and I'm good at. And I started developing a reputation, if you will, where people, I would just hear me being talked about kind of in my circles as a connector. And I kind of got that was what people think about when they hear my name, I started being more conscious about cultivating that. So to take this to the example of Google, so let's take a typical example that, you know, someone wants, let's say, a management consulting job, because I assume most of the people on the line are, that's what they're interested in, and they submit a resume and they've never heard of your name. So they basically they look at your resume and, you know, it's pretty hard to get across anything that's going to stand out that much on a resume. I'm not trying to say resumes are irrelevant, but, you know, if you have a GPA that's a few points higher than someone else, you know, if you went to, you know, Harvard, well, a lot of people went to Harvard, and, you know, if you were, you know, president of a certain kind of organization, you know, a lot of people do those kind of things. I'm not trying to say they're bad. It's just that it doesn't really stand out all that much. Now, if they Google your name and they find top results, and they will Google your name, they find top results, a blog where you have 2 years of archives of very insightful commentary on the field that you want to be consulting in, that shows that you have read the literature, that has reviews of books, that has maybe case studies of different consulting you've done in different contexts, whether professional or even going out and consulting for a charity and writing about that, they're going to think, if they see that, they're going to think, wow, this is someone who knows their stuff. This is someone who gets things done. This is someone who has initiative, and that's going to become your personal brand, is those positive things.
Well, it's interesting. I think I would distinguish the personal brand in two different contexts, right? Both of which I think are useful. I want to make sure people on the call understand the difference, though. One is building your personal brand within an organization, so your internal personal brand, and one is the external.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what you just mentioned around people searching for you. By the way, that's standard business practice, incidentally, for everyone who's listening around HR organizations, is, you know, they get a resume, they Google you, they Facebook you.
Yeah.
And more for you know, entry level jobs, they're mostly looking for embarrassing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so is there anything on there they don't want to be associated with? You know, so that the party you were super drunk at and you did something really stupid and you put it all over Facebook on purpose.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can't get rid of that stuff. So the first thing to realize on a personal brand is, you know, it's better to have no brand than a negative one.
Right.
So worry about that. And then I think what you talked about is, I think, appropriate in two areas especially. One is the post-consulting career, where, you know, after you've gone, most people do sort of a tour of duty in these firms, and then they go off and do something different. There you certainly get looked at a lot in terms of people looking at what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And then also your clients. So what happens is your bio is typically given, you know, to clients in advance of you actually meeting them or even realizing you're on the engagement. And they will Google you because it's so easy, right? And so, again, if you have bad stuff, that's a bad thing. But if there are insightful things you've written about, you know, that's all very, 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 very positive.
Right.
So I think in those two areas that applies particularly well, particularly if it applies to
And the vast majority of information out there is about avoiding the negative, and that is important.
Yes.
It is very important. But it's not enough. That just gets you in the door. There's a really interesting story from my research on this topic. So I interviewed Seth Godin for my book. I'm sure, you know, most callers are familiar with the business author Seth Godin. He has a very controversial post called I'm forgetting the title right now. But if you Google Seth Godin and resume, he has a post about questioning the importance of resume compared to this kind of personal branding we're talking about. So I was interviewing, I was talking to him about this, and he was going on, and he was saying, he said, you know, if you wanted to get a job as a, say, an airline safety consultant, a consultant on airline safety, aviation safety, you know, you could go to school and, you know, get all these credentials, or you could write a blog, write the number one blog on aviation safety. And as soon as he said that, my jaw hit the floor, because I actually happen to know the person who writes the number one blog on aviation safety. Her name is Christine Negroni. She's the mother of a friend of mine, and she didn't complete college. She has no formal credentials whatsoever to be offering that service. But she just from a very young age, she started reporting on it. She in college was a TV reporter and started just took that beat and was reporting and got to know everyone in the field and worked her way up and began writing about it and blogging on it, and now, you know, she's an expert on that field. And this is a point that that I think is very important, is what I would call the decentralization of expertise. So in the past, before the net, expertise was highly centralized. So if you wanted to present yourself as an expert on some field, you had to pass through a lot of gates. You had to get, you know, high credentials in the academic field related to that. You had to go through organizations, work your way up, get positions of authority and leadership, and maybe, you know, in your old age, you might be able to call yourself an expert in that field. Well, what's happened with the web is that anyone can go on and just start being an expert. Not that everyone will start doing the things that experts do, which is comment on things. And now, that's not to say everyone will regard you as an expert, but if you start doing the kinds of things that experts do, such as make opinions, you know, offer your opinions, write commentaries, and it's good stuff, and it actually passes muster and it applies, you will become considered an expert in that field in very short order. And it's just something that's fundamentally changed in the last 10 years or so.
Well, let me draw sort of two distinctions there. I think one is there is being an expert, and then there's being perceived as an expert.
Yeah,
and I think you'd agree that these are two different things. and I certainly encourage folks that learn from me to do both.
Yeah.
So actually know something, be competent at something.
Yeah.
And then also be perceived as being competent.
Right.
Because they are indeed very different.
Yeah.
What I wanted is just link back to something you mentioned earlier that thought sort of ties into the conversation we're having now, and we're talking about personal branding and building a personal brand, and you know one of the things you mentioned, and I've talked about this quite a bit, is you were very good at listening to how others talked about you, and the word connector came up. I think I even probably mentioned to you early on that, you know, one of the things I think about when I think about you, particularly early on, is just you're a great connector. And my advice to connectors is connectors should connect.
Yeah.
That's your. And so I want to introduce this concept of, which my audience is familiar with. It's called the personal competitive advantage, mm-hmm. which is knowing and being self-aware of what you're really, really, really good at
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
focusing on it. So for you, it's being the connector.
Yeah.
For me, the comments I get a lot, and I didn't realize this about myself, is, you know, usually I do a lot of coaching or consulting or teaching. So it's always about sort of some sort of information sharing. And the thing I get a lot is two words, simplification and clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens mm-hmm. is people say I have a knack for taking very complicated things and communicating them in a very simple way, whether that's macroeconomic
yeah.
policy or a particular type of interview format in consulting. And when I heard that, you know, the first time I didn't think much of it. But, you know, like
yes.
the third, fourth, fifth time, like, you know, everyone keeps saying it. So it must
yeah.
be at least somewhat true, right?
Yeah.
And so then I started thinking about, and this was the point I wanted to tie into actually being an expert, as in addition to being perceived as one,
mm-hmm.
is once you know what that is, you know, that's your personal competitive advantage. That's something
mm-hmm.
you can do better than others or better than the average person.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, like you mentioned, it's very much worth cultivating
mm-hmm.
and being aware of that. So for me, it was once I realized I'm good with complicated things made simple, which didn't seem that unusual to me because I couldn't tell. They were, you know, I just sort of saw it a certain way and I realized that that wasn't typical.
Yeah.
I started seeking out opportunities
where
there were things that were complicated.
And one thought I have on that is around the job interviews. Now, I've never done a job interview for a super high-powered consulting, corporate consulting type job that many of the callers may have been on. I have made my living as a freelance consultant quite extensively, but it's slightly different than, you know, getting a full-time employment, or quite different. But I have found, and so take this with a grain of salt and you know, translate it to your own circumstance. I found that I've gotten very good results being extremely clear and extremely honest about what I'm really good at and what I'm really bad at. And so part of it is knowing that, and part of it is communicating it. So I'm very clear that I am great at ideas. I'm great at communicating ideas, coming up with them, clarifying them. Anything in the world of ideas, words, concepts, persuasion, I'm very, very good at. And I'm also clear that if you give me a list of highly detailed, organized tasks to execute on, I'm going to probably botch it. That's not how my brain works, and I'm not good at that kind of thing. So I have found through experience, and actually some of this experience, I laugh, was gained when I was doing some intern work for you, and I found myself in a position doing a lot of highly detailed project management for you, and we both kind of mutually agreed, you know what, maybe this isn't the best fit. And so
I was laughing because I was thinking the same thing, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I knew you were going to be thinking that. So since that experience, I have told people, I said, look, this is what I'm really good at, and this is what I'm horrible at. And that does a couple of things. One, it makes sure we're a match, because if they're looking for what I'm good at, then we're great. And if they're looking for what I'm bad at, then it's going to end up in a situation like I had with you, where we kind of just are both like, maybe this isn't working. Which is not what you want to optimize for. Second, and this is really important, it shows honesty. And, you know, that is something that is extremely important to employers, is they don't want a BS artist. They don't want a slickster. They want someone who is clear about the value they can offer, the value they can't offer, and who is communicating about it very authentically and accurately, and that is highly valued by any client or employer. And this actually goes back to sales, because that's a very relevant concept to keep in mind when you're selling.
It very much is. And as it relates to the management consulting field, I'll tell you who people who are very good at this, about being very clear what they're good at and what they're not, or what their firm is very good at and what their firm is not, are partners at consulting firms.
Mm-hmm.
When you sit in and eavesdrop on their, you know, quote unquote sales calls, they shouldn't sound like sales calls at all, which is a different story. But
mm-hmm.
They're very honest. You know, for this kind of stuff, this is right up our alley. We totally can do it. For this thing over here, you know, I really don't think we're any good at that. And really, I'll try to find a referral for you.
Yeah.
And what happens is, by doing that, is they trust you more.
Yeah.
Because you just gave them advice that's against their own self-interest. Them turning away business by pushing you somewhere else,
yeah.
And they feel like, well, there's high integrity there,
yeah.
And it works extremely well. You've done it. I've done it in my work, and all the various partners of the top firms do that as well. So it's something that's a lot of the newer consultants don't see that, because they don't get access to those conversations, but it's very much true.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it's actually even related to marketing, in that I have a whole chapter about street smart marketing in my book. That's another thing. A lot of the people, the self-made people that I talk about, are very interested in is marketing, and typically that's another one of those words that has a kind of bad ring to it. It sounds, you know, we experience a lot of marketing all day long. Most of it is annoying, and we'd prefer not to have experienced it, so we have a bad association with it. But what I write about from interviewing, interviewed Sean Parker, the founding president of Facebook, and totally incidentally, I'm actually making this call from his home right now, because I'm helping
really?
Him on something.
That's hilarious.
And I met him interviewing him for the book, so there's an example of networking. So he was very passionate about this point. He said, that marketing has to start way, way, way earlier than it does in the process than most people do it. So most people create a product that they want to create or that they happen to have on hand or have talent to build, and then they think, okay, the product's done, service is available, how do I market it? And Sean said that is completely too late, that the marketing is almost a form of product design where you're, if you think about the word marketing, you are finding a market that has a problem. You're finding a market that has an unsolved need, and tailoring an offering to that unsolved need. And if you can be really, really clear about what unsolved need you're meeting, which unsolved needs you are and which one you aren't meeting, the marketing is not going to feel sleazy. It's going to feel more like a conversation that's basically like, are we a match for each other? Do you have this problem? If you do, great, because I'm great at solving that. If you don't, then you know, here's someone who's really good at solving the problem you do have, and it's not me. So this all ties back to marketing as well.
Great. Actually, my connection dropped for a second, so I missed a little bit of what you said.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to circle back to something and just to draw just a greater distinction around, again, building a personal brand, and but both internally and externally, because I think the way you take these principles and apply them is a little bit differently. Within an organization, I have mentioned very consistently that your personal brand or your reputation, particularly in a professional services environment and in a corporate environment, is extremely important, and it's like really everything. So if you screw that up, mm-hmm. you know, really the advice I got from someone was if your personal brand inside an organization has been screwed up,
mm-hmm.
But your external is either neutral or doesn't exist, you're really better off quitting and starting
yes.
over somewhere else.
Yes.
Once it's negative, it's very hard to turn around.
Yeah.
So that's one thought. And what strikes me as the things you've mentioned, the common theme I see around building a personal brand is this shift from sort of a credential-oriented authority figureness
mm-hmm.
To one of being an authority through demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
So what I see around all this online blogging and stuff is
mm-hmm.
you don't say, I have this degree, therefore I'm an expert.
Right.
It's, look, I'm just going to do what I do. You can watch.
Yes.
And then you decide if I'm any good. Right?
Exactly. So this is so important, and I'm so glad you brought this up. And I'll use a dating analogy here, and don't worry, I won't get too risque here. But imagine two different dates, one where a guy is smitten with a lady, and he's sitting there at dinner talking, saying, you know, I'm so charming, I'm really funny, I'm a funny guy, I'm dashing, I'm gallant, I'm polite. And basically just talking about all these qualities. How impressive will that be? How attracted, how intrigued will the lady be? Versus a guy who doesn't say any of those words, and he just starts making her laugh. So he's funny. He performs. He makes her laugh. He's funny. He, you know, gets up and pulls out her chair when she comes to the table, so he demonstrates gallantry. You know, he has good table manners, so he demonstrates being polite instead of saying he's polite. So there's certain things around the branding where you can't, it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good to talk about it. You just actually have to do it and
yeah.
have people see that you're good at doing it.
By the way, that's the number one marketing technique managing consulting firm partners use to sell to Fortune 500 CEOs.
Yes.
They don't tell them they're good. They just show them they're good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
It works really well, and particularly
yeah.
for a very sophisticated audience.
Yeah. So, absolutely. So I do have a fair amount of experience selling my services, marketing, copywriting, marketing consulting services to freelance clients, corporations on a freelance basis, and that is the essence of my sales technique, is I don't go in there and have some PowerPoint and talk about all my accomplishments and how great I am. I ask them what problem why they brought me in. Like, why do they think I was relevant to some problem? They start talking about the problem, and I start not only giving them ideas about that problem, because we all know ideas are a dime a dozen. There's some reason that those ideas haven't been implemented yet, so I
mm-hmm.
start guiding them through how I would coach them to implement those problems. And it's not giving a free coaching session. It's actually guiding them towards more clarity about what this problem is. And they can then see that I actually know how to consult because I'm consulting with them in that very session about what they care about. And then it's usually the feeling is, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. Let's work with him.
It's interesting you say that because I have a client who runs a public speaking training consulting firm and based in Silicon Valley, and their clients are most of the CEOs in the Valley. You know, mm-hmm. so before a big presentation to Wall Street or raise capital or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I asked the owner how she sold, she says, "I don't really sell. I just start advising them."
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, it's like, so tell me about the speech you have coming up. Well, it's like I have my, I have all 5,000 salespeople flying in from around the world, you know, for this meeting, and I can only afford to do it once a year, and I got to tell them these three things, and you know, I can't blow it because you know, sales will tank, right? And they'll all quit.
Yeah.
And so she'll start just helping that client, that prospective client, immediately.
Yeah.
And then before you realize it, it's the client, that first prospect, it's already a client relationship before any kind of formal arrangement.
Absolutely.
And they can see that it works.
Yeah. That is so brilliant, and it's related to many different things. I can think of three different topics on this call that what you just said is related to. One is personal brand in the organization. So if I have a whole chapter in my book called The Entrepreneurial Mindset versus the Employee Mindset. Now, this is mindset. It's not about whether you're an entrepreneur or an employee. It's about the kind of mindset you have. So most of the people on this call are employees and get a W-2 form and not a 1099. But that doesn't mean that you should have necessarily the mindset of an employee versus being proactive and thinking of your work organization like in an entrepreneurial situation where you're actually figuring out what the problems are that aren't being solved. Because if there's every organization has problems that aren't being solved, which means there is a vacuum of leadership to solve it. So there is not currently the leadership to solve that problem. Well, if you just start taking the leadership, I mean, tactfully, you know, within not stepping on people's toes, but if you just start stepping up and saying, okay, I'm gonna solve this problem, and here's how we're going to solve it. No one else is solving it. Here's my solution. And you actually start leading that, you will be, you will be on the first short list for promotion because you're not talking about what a leader you are. You're actually being a leader, and so of course you're going to be promoted as a leader.
Well, it's interesting. I think I totally agree with that point, and I think though, however, some folks on the call, some of them are very early in their careers, perhaps first job in some cases, and I think they sometimes wonder, well, geez, what do I know that could be of use in such a such an illustrious organization? And what I want to point out is to not underestimate what you know. So I'll give you some hypothetical examples. You know, if the firm you end up working at, when you would think back to when they were recruiting on campus, let's say, and they did something that really sort of didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they left out the engineering school. And they had a lot of bright people there because they only went after the business school or whatever it happens to be. And the people who were involved in recruiting, they're alumni from 5 or 10 years ago. So they're a little out of touch. But you notice this sort of problem. Well, you can do one of two things. The employee attitude is, well, geez, we'll just complain about it and nothing's going to change. The entrepreneurial mindset attitude is, well, I'm going to go fix it. I'm going to go suggest it. I'm going to bring some attention to it. I'm going to give them alternatives. I'm going to analyze it for them. I'm going to show them why it's a better way and help lay that path. With working with a client, one area that a lot of the more junior consultants have access to that partners and clients don't is usually it's the junior consultants that are doing interviews with frontline employees and with like your client's customers because there's so many of them typically. And so you're going to have a much better feel for when your client's customers complain, what are they complaining about? Do they care a little about this issue or a lot? And there's this context you can provide that the CEO of an organization just won't get because they're a little bit more out of touch. So there are a lot of little things that can provide a lot of value. And so I just want to make sure people realize that not to underestimate what they can contribute to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. On this topic of proactive, providing of value, that's almost my religion. I do.
It is. It really is, actually.
I'm obsessed with this. You are. I talk to people, not everyone, not like walking up to strangers in the street, but people that are in my business world that I would like to connect with, and I don't just chit chat. I mean, people almost get annoyed by it. I'm constantly asking, what are you really up to? Like, what? I know you're doing a lot of things, but which is the one that you're most excited about? Oh, that. Okay. So what's going on with that? What challenges are you having with that? That word challenges is great. No one likes to admit they have a problem, but everyone likes to admit they have a challenge. So if you ask people, because that means they're doing big things.
Right.
And, climbing Mount Everest is a challenge, not a problem. That's why people do it. So what challenges are you facing with that? And then I start steering the conversation in ways where I know that I can add value. So I'll start asking them, oh, you're doing that project. Well, you're writing copy around that? And they'll say, oh, we've had a lot of problem. We can't find a good copywriter. Or often they'll show me their copy, and I'll just say, you know what, I don't mean to offend you here at all, but I am a copywriter, and I see a lot of ways that this could be improved. Would you be curious about hearing some of my thoughts? If you say it politely, I've never had someone not interested in that. It's provided it's an area that you have some credibility in. So my point around all this is that if you just get into that habit of being helpful in high leverage ways, not low leverage ways, not like grabbing people's coffee and making photocopies for them, but like really inquiring about what they're up to and finding how you can fit as a piece of the puzzle in what they're up to in a very high value leverage way, you're going to be a popular person among your clients, in your office, among your bosses who are considering whom to promote. You will be, your personal brand, as we've been defining it here, will be very positive.
And totally agree with that. And I guess just give a couple examples within the construct of a consulting firm. One of the things partners often have difficulty grasping is how is morale amongst the associates or the analysts? Because sometimes, if you have a formal meeting, the analysts and associates aren't always candid, with partners. So one of the things I used to do is I used to say, there's been a lot of talk amongst my peer group around this new policy change or whatever. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the feedback, but if you're interested, so you always ask for permission. If you're interested, I'd be happy to share it with you. And you can say that. The same conversation works with clients. Ms. CEO, I understand that, you have a 10,000 person organization. But I want to let you know that there is this grumbling, amongst your customer service staff, and they seem very upset about certain things. Morale does not seem to be that good. If you're interested, I'd be happy to share with you what they are saying, anonymously, of course, to give you a gist of what's going on there. And that role, by the way, is what I call giving the other person, having your thumb on the pulse of things, an audience that they don't have access to. It's very valuable in that particular environment, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a book. My book really is about self-education, street smart education. And ironically enough, I actually do recommend a lot of books. I mean, it is a book. I recommend a lot of books. You can actually learn street smarts from books. They tend to be different books than the ones that are taught in formal context.
Sure.
And there's a book that I found very useful by Thomas Stanley called Networking with the Affluent. Networking with the Affluent. You can probably find it on Amazon. And basically the book, he breaks down different useful roles you can play in affluent people's lives. So there's like the kind of sounding board, the trusted advisor, the connector, the revenue enhancer, where you're kind of proactively looking for ways to add revenue. There's all these roles that you can proactively take that are not just a cookie cutter job description. They're proactive. They're demonstrating that entrepreneurial mindset that all the people I interviewed excelled at.
It's interesting. That was definitely a theme that I noticed from your book around. I think you use the word self-education quite a bit in there. Mm-hmm. And I tend to use something similar. I use the phrase lifelong learner.
Yeah.
And actually, what I noticed about you, by the way, and I may have mentioned this before, but I'll tell you now, was you know, I could tell 4 years ago. Obviously, you're fairly young, much younger than my typical clients that are, mm-hmm. you know, CEOs typically of businesses, maybe as small as $5 million in sales, as large as 130. Mm-hmm. And we've had a formal business relationship where you were a client. And mm-hmm. what was interesting about sort of how you conducted your behavior, which I thought was interesting, was I could tell that you were just fanatical about this lifelong learning thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. when I hired you to do some project work for me, you know, I offered to pay you, turned me down because you wanted instead to just a chance to learn from me.
Yes.
Like, okay, if I coach you or train you.
Yeah, and here was my reasoning, actually. I had very specific reasoning about that.
You did? I didn't know that. Okay.
Which is this. If, you know, I was young, you know, it was 4 years ago. I was much less experienced in business than I am now, much less successful and, you know, earning much less money. So, you know, if you had paid me a fair rate for my experience then, it would have been fairly low because that would have been a fair rate for what I was bringing to the table. And I knew that if I accepted that money, there would be a kind of transaction where it was like, okay, he's done his work, and now I paid him, and we're good. But here I'm going to, you know, gush a little bit, but when I sat in on one of your masterminds 4 years ago as a guest, and the second you started talking, I knew you were different. I knew I had to learn from you. I didn't have the money then to be your client. And I just knew that if I worked for you for free, like teachings were going to rub off on me, and you were probably going to take more of an interest in helping me out and giving me value than if you had just sort of completed the transaction by writing some check. And that's actually, I think, what did happen. And so, you can often get you can trade effort for education. You don't necessarily have to go spend a lot of money on education. You can, and it can be useful, but you can also get education. There's a very long tradition around this, around, you know, apprenticeship, you know, the kind of the master and apprentice. I mean, this is a long, long tradition, and I think it's been lost a little bit. The idea of learning from a master.
Well, I'm flattered in the way you frame that context there. But I totally agree with you that, I mean, I learn from others. You know, one of my first jobs in college, I was cold calling for Merrill Lynch, and I did it for free. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 hours a week calling. I remember my script even. Hi, this is Victor Chang. I'm a student intern, very important, mm-hmm. calling from Merrill Lynch. Wanted to see if you're interested in learning more about tax-free income. You know, could I sign up for an appointment with our broker in the office? And so this was my thing. I mean, did so many times, like it's been decades, I still know the pitch. And what happens when you, by the way, when you work for free for somebody or just help them out, so it could be within an organization, not necessarily a formal financial relationship, is if you help them out, they feel, first of all, there's a great sense of reciprocity. They mm-hmm. feel a little guilty. Mm-hmm. They either have to give you really interesting work or mm-hmm. to alleviate some of that guilt, they feel like they ought to help you out a little bit, you know, more than they would just a vendor.
Yeah.
So you're in a slightly different category. And that year we met, I mean, I wrote lots of checks to lots of different vendors, but you're the only one I have a relationship with, you know, 4 years later that's like this. And so it's interesting that, you know, we're having the conversation because it's kind of in full circle.
Yeah, absolutely. And this brings us to a point that you asked, you know, what was really common with these people, what was surprising. A very large number of the self-made, self-educated millionaires and billionaires I talked with over the last 2 years talked very passionately about a mentor they had. And this is, if you think about it, I think that our formal education system has inappropriately monopolized the word education. In that it obviously is education, but what happens is people think that's the only form of education. And I think that's actually dangerous because what happens is people graduate their highest level of education, formal education they're going to get. Maybe it's a bachelor's degree at 22 or a master's in their mid-20s, an MBA law degree in their mid-20s, and they get that final degree. And they think, great, my education is over. And I actually think that's very dangerous. The people that I interviewed were seeking out mentors, seeking out people who had the success they wanted from young age to an old age. They kept seeking more people out. They were always humble, always knowing that there were people they could learn from, and using some of the networking tips that we've been talking about, using the networking tips that I talked about in that video that I believe you sent out to the people on this list mm-hmm. about a month ago, to bring these mentors into their life. And you can get enormous, enormous education from successful people out there. But you have to learn, you have to actually get an education first in how to bring those people in. And it has a lot to do with the things we've been talking about on this call in terms of giving, proactively demonstrating value, and connecting, networking, and you can get a real education in success for free from successful people.
I totally agree with that. I think one thing I'd point out is that there are a lot of people in this world that know a lot about something but may not have the pedigree that I think some folks on this call might be accustomed to. So as an example of that, you know, I have several teachers, not informal mentors. These were more like, buying their materials and going to workshops and learning from them. But I have several teachers that I've learned from the past several years that are high school dropouts. Mm-hmm. I have one in particular that comes to mind. He had a very particular skill that I wanted to learn a lot about. And he was like a high school dropout. He was formerly homeless in New York City and used to be a drug addict, strung out on, I think it was crack. And got himself cleaned up and built like a $10 million a year business from being homeless, walking the streets of New York City.
Wow.
And I learned from him, and I didn't judge him. I didn't say, well, you know, you don't have a Harvard MBA. What could you possibly know? Mm-hmm. I said, I looked at results, and I said, well, he's got something that I would like to learn. And I found a way to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can learn from a lot of different places, and I do that quite a bit. And I think it's important not to prejudge. And I think this is a problem, I think, for folks on the call that at least habitually we'll get into some problems. You'll find a lot of people with Ivy League degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, I think, overplace the value of that degree to the point where they're going to rub it in everyone's face. Like, well,
right.
at Harvard, we learned this, right?
Right.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Because it kind of just pisses people off.
Right.
And also, don't let it cloud your own thinking such that you refuse to learn from anything other than Harvard. There's a lot of great places to learn, not just at the top universities.
Yeah. So, on that point, I'm going to say something slightly controversial, just slightly. I think that once you get to a pretty good level of academic achievement, like B+ kind of level, the returns you get on going from that B+ level over a lifetime. I'm not talking like your first job, which it really does help to have better grades, but over lifetime career success, earnings, happiness in life, the returns you get from going from that B level to the A or the A+ level are actually less than the returns you would get by staying in that academic area at a moderate or kind of a slightly above average level, but then going out and adding a bunch of these street smart skills that most people who get the A's don't have at all. So learning all the connecting, the soft skills, the communication skills, the social intelligence, the sales, basically the skills that I write about in my book. If you're getting like F's and D's, you know, that could really be a problem.
Sure.
Some people in my book got those and they dropped out and they did great. But you know, it's very helpful to have a solid academic, analytical, IQ type intelligence. But once it's kind of solid and pretty darn good, I would put forward that our system inappropriately encourages people to go further into their academic knowledge when the system overall of their life would actually be optimized by adding some other skills in there. So it's actually like there's concepts like the weakest link or the limiting factor in systems where, let's say you're just a genius at, you know, some kind of academic skill, and you're like genius level and you're the best in the world. You may actually have a limiting factor where, let's say you are a horrible communicator or just have horrible people skills. It's possible that will be your limiting factor and you would actually achieve much more success overall by improving those people skills and not focusing as much improving, going the next level on the academic skills.
I would totally corroborate that. And in fact, when I was at McKinsey, one of the analyses that I saw around recruiting, this was a while back, was was there, someone did an analysis of, people, excuse me one second, did an analysis of, they compared people's, McKinsey people's performance on the job 2 or 3 years after they were hired compared to their resume at the point of being hired.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what they found was beyond a certain GPA, higher did not correlate to better promotability or better on-the-job performance. And I think the cutoff was something around, anyone with a 3.5 or higher GPA from a top school, it didn't matter if you were 3.5 or 4.0, the performance was identical on the job.
Right.
Same with, like, SAT scores, beyond a certain point, and I forget what the exact cutoff was, if it was higher, it didn't make much of a difference. And so what they found was the ideal prototype was someone with essentially like a B+/A- GPA, sort of right around that point.
Mm-hmm.
Someone with sort of like, I forget the exact score number, but high SAT scores but not perfect,
mm-hmm.
Or high GMAT scores but not perfect. And to your point, Michael, having some sort of leadership role where they've been
mm-hmm.
forced to learn how to deal with conflict, to negotiate, mm-hmm. to lead others, to sell people on ideas or to recruit
mm-hmm.
them to join an organization,
mm-hmm.
and all those things. And they found that was more of the optimal prototype for
right.
all the reasons you cited, being able to deal with clients and not just do the analysis, but actually talk about the analysis in an intelligent
right.
way. So I totally agree with that.
So, yes, absolutely. And actually, we're going to jump into some questions in a moment. I do want to leave, before we go into questions, want to leave one thought on that, is that, I think a lot of people on the call they're wanting to become management consultants, they want to go into this field, and my guesses are, quite stressed out about the, the status, the prestige, am I going to get into the top firms, McKinsey, where am I going to be in the pecking order, and are going through a great deal of stress and competition. And you know what? If that's your dream, if your dream is to get in one of those top firms, then you've got to do what you've got to do to get in there. And the people on the call know better than I do, what is necessary. But what I know quite a bit now from having met all these people is that over the course of a life, not your first job, but over the course of a career, it is possible to start from very bad circumstances. I mean, much worse than like not getting into your top choice consulting firm. But like, people who, I have interviewed people whose parents were crack addicts, who were beaten as kids. Everyone in my book was self-made. None of them grew up rich. Some of them were middle class, but a lot of them grew up in very, very hard circumstances. And they were able, through these street smart skills, to build a great life for themselves. So I guess my message is, if you want to, if you're absolutely set on getting on one of those top positions, then go for it and do what you have to do. But if you don't have to, you have a choice to not be that stressed out. It is possible to just start getting experience, start building your brand online, start developing your personal brand, and go on a more kind of snowball effect over time where you're building up credibility over time, and that's what all the people I interviewed in my book did, and they did very well for themselves.
Great. So let's do three things. I want to comment on what you just said, but before I do that, I want to open things up for questions and answers. If you could do two things, Michael. One is explain how people can ask a question and what the process
sure.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, while they're asking their questions or getting queued up, if you could tell people when your book's coming out, how to get it, that would be very useful.
Great. So we've got about 200 people on the webcast right now. So if you're on the webcast, you should have a welcome screen there that has a question box in the lower left. You can submit a question. We've already got some there, and I'll just answer those. I'll read the question and answer them. If you are on the phone, we have about 60 people on the phone, you can press *2 and that will raise your hand, and then we probably will have a bunch of questions, but at some point I will use your first name and say your area code and say, hey, you're live and you can ask your question. And obviously just remember there's 300 people listening here and this will be recorded and given to probably more. So, you know, be mindful of how much you want to reveal of your personal identity or vulnerable things like that. So anyone who has a question can press *2 or if you're on the webinar, you can submit it on that box.
And Michael, how do people find out more about your book and how to get
great.
It?
Great. Yeah. So as people, you're thinking your questions or submitting them. So the book is available for pre-order now. It's coming out in about 1 week exact, almost a week exactly, on the next Thursday. And it's you can go to any online retailer. It's called The Education of Millionaires, The Education of Millionaires by me, Michael Ellsberg. And you know, Amazon has it. It's $17 if you just go to Amazon. If you go to my site, ellsberg.com, ellsberg.com, there's links to it there. And I'll just make a really brief kind of pitch for this book and why I think it makes sense. It's basically we've been talking about education outside of formal environments. And you know, my book is not going to give you all the education you need for the rest of your life in these street smart areas. You could never accomplish that in one book. But what it does accomplish very, very well is give you a roadmap for the initial start of starting your path or continuing and going more advanced in your path of this street smart education. So it's a curriculum, if you will, with real life examples from all these self-educated millionaires and billionaires. Some of them are quite famous, other ones are not famous but are doing very cool things. And you know, it's $17 now. I think that's a great investment in your education, if I do say so myself. It's available now. If you buy it now or any time after you buy it, shoot an email to me at privatelist@ellsberg.com, privatelist@ellsberg.com, ellsberg.com. And I've written somewhere like 50 or 75 or maybe even 100, I've got to count exactly, pages that are great material and that just weren't, there wasn't room for them in the book or they didn't quite fit the focus of the book around self-education. Specifically, I have a whole section on kind of self-education and personal matters, your health, your nutrition, your social intelligence, relationships, which not only obviously are very important for your happiness, but they do affect your career very much. I have a lot of stories about that, which I won't get into. So you get those bonuses if you buy it. Send me an email at privatelist@ellsberg.com. And that is all I'll say about the book. It's out there and available. And let us take some questions. So *2 if you're on the phone. And I will go first to some written questions here. So what do we have here? Here's an interesting one. This is from Timothy from Columbus. Is there any such thing as an overabundance of experts in a field? Is there always room for one more? I think that's a great question. So probably you've noticed if you go to networking events, business events, you meet a lot of people who are social media experts. Like that's, if you say, well, what are you up to? They say, oh, I'm a social media consultant. I do social media for corporations. And it becomes so common, and I don't mean to offend anyone who that's their job out there, but just you hear that so much now that when you hear it again, if that's how they describe themselves, it's almost like, oh, well, join the club. And it's like, do we really need another social media consultant? So it's kind of, you want to think like the low end and the high end. Like the low end of any field, whether it's consulting or really anything, is always overpopulated. There's always wannabes, people who aren't really providing value, people who aren't who just aren't really providing much. And so that it's always crowded, and the world doesn't need more of those people. But if you're really good at what you do, that actually is, it's lonely at the top. I don't care how crowded the field is, you know, people will always want a good doctor. There's a lot of doctors out there, and people will always want a good doctor. You know, there are a lot of people who claim to be marketing consultants, revenue, you know, Victor used the term, you know, business growth consultants. There's a fair number of people who call themselves that. Very few of them actually get the results that Victor gets and that I've seen him get in my life and in my wife's life. She was a client of his, other people I know. If you get those results, you know, you'll always be in demand. I don't care how many other people are calling themselves what they call you. You'll always be in demand. So that is that. Do you have any thoughts on that, Victor?
Yeah, I would sort of introduce the topic of a niche.
Mm-hmm.
I've covered elsewhere, but it's very relevant to our conversation here. Is if you want to advance the fastest in your career, whether it's within an organization or outside, it really, really pays to specialize. To be the big fish in a very small pond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since you can't change the size of the fish because you are who you are, but you can change which pond you play in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that I think is a profoundly strategic decision. Sometimes it happens by accident. Other times it can be a deliberate choice. So, for example, McKinsey in the late 90s when I was there, you know, I was one of the firm's leading experts in subprime lending, unfortunately, and selling loans to Wall Street. So the entire cause of the Great Recession that we've had a couple of years ago, you know, I was the firm's expert in that area like a decade or more before it happened. And you could argue, and people did argue, that, you know, the finance sector is extremely well understood, lots of mortgage experts globally, internally within McKinsey and externally, but there's this new area called subprime, which is a very, very small percentage of the total at the time, you know, like very tiny percentage. And I just happened to know a lot about it. And so I started writing a lot, talking about building your personal brand within an organization. If you get a chance to write, either externally or internally, or to publish or to share or to give a presentation or write an article, so we have the McKinsey Quarterly, you absolutely should take advantage of it. If you have the chance to publish externally, sometimes it cannot be in the context of your job because sometimes there's some conflict of agreements you have to sign. But if you can build a reputation outside of your firm too, that's a great thing. And the trick there is to pick something very specialized. You know, so, for example, many of the folks on this call know of me from one of my websites called caseinterview.com. And it's about, I mean, it's really about how to get a job at one of, like, seven companies in the world. Not how to get a job in general, because there's thousands of employees, but like seven companies, and that's it. It's extremely narrow. And so I've become reasonably well-known in a very, very narrow field. And I have people have asked me, can you go broader than that? You know, how to get jobs in general, to be successful in your career in general. And I'm like, no, not really, because this is my edge. This is my area of specialty. If I focus on it, I'm pretty comfortable I can continue to do a good job. As I branch out, it becomes harder. And certainly when you start off, it's better to be known extremely well for one small thing than to spread yourself too thin. So that's kind of my 2 cents on that.
Great. Yeah, great material. So people are a little shy on the star twos on the phone. If you do want to talk on the phone, you're welcome to, and press star two and we'll unmute you. As people are thinking their questions, let's go back to, we have a bunch of great questions here on the internet. Now here is one that I think is probably relevant to a lot of people, and this one is from Lynn in Beirut, which is interesting. I was actually just in Beirut, Lynn. My wife's sister married a Lebanese man, so I was there for the first time. So Lynn asks, I'm trying to figure out which is most strategic for an ambitious career, starting to work within the industry to get solid experience in the field and then shift to consulting, or vice versa, to go from consulting and therefore some experience in many industries to a particular industry that would have particularly interested me. I have a very strong opinion on that. Victor, you may have a different opinion, but I'll share my strong opinion. I feel very strongly about the latter. That it is, in my experience, for me and for people I've seen, that have better luck starting out with some kind of freelance, flexible, self-employed type work, and then if they want, I mean, usually it's so satisfying that it just stay that way, but if they want, can then go go work for, you know, go get a job once they kind of have the credibility and personal brand. There's a couple reasons for that, why I believe that. One is that it's a great way to meet potential employers. I mean, you're, instead of being the kind of wannabe, for lack of a better word, you know, asking for a job, begging for a job, you know, number 533 in the resume stack, you're the one they're coming to for expertise, advice. You're all of a sudden you're an authority figure for them. They also get to try before they buy. They get to see your value. They get to tangibly experience the value you provide to the organization. And in my experience, you can really have the pick of the litter of your clients if you have a freelance portfolio. If you do decide you want full-time employment, if you are a good consultant freelance, you will a lot of your clients will try to get you to work for them full-time. I've experienced it, you know, many, many times. I've had very high-profile people trying to get me to work for their organization, people I never would have had a shot with had I, you know, just submitted a resume cold. So that's my view. Victor, do you have a different take on this?
I guess it depends on how what the intention of the question. If the question is, mm-hmm. you know, should I go work for a consulting firm that serves lots of different industries as a strategy to get into the industry I really want to work in, or should I just go into that industry directly? I mean, both paths, you know, people have been successful at both, and it's largely dependent on, you know, which one you're more interested in. You know, for mm-hmm. me, I was choosing at the time between consulting or had contemplated staying in Silicon Valley and going right into tech because that was an area that I was interested in. And I ultimately came mm-hmm. back, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, though, is how you present yourself down the road is very different. So for example, my background, I work in lots of different industries, some of by conscious choice and mostly because of a sort of a pseudo attention deficit problem.
Mm-hmm.
When I present myself to a client, they'll say, well, how much experience do you have in the retail display industry? So when you walk into a drugstore or a grocery store, they put the stuff in the merchandising, like mm-hmm. that stuff, the physical mm-hmm. device they put the products in. You know, that's an industry. And so I have a client that's in that field, and they ask me, how much experience do you have? And I say, well, candidly, I have no experience in that industry. But you know what?
Mm-hmm.
I know what every other industry is doing, how they're dealing with the same problems you have around sales and profitability and margin and the changing of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're curious how everyone else is dealing with it, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But I look around the room, you have, you know, 300 years of experience about this industry, and
mm-hmm.
collectively it looks like you have very little of every other one. So that's
mm-hmm.
my role. So
mm-hmm.
you present your value add in a potentially different way.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I don't think there is a set strategy of either one being the right one. I think it has to do with how much you care about it. I like breadth early in a career because, you know, sometimes you don't know what you like.
Mm-hmm.
So there's value in trying to check out a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're pretty sure you know an area that that's what you really want to do, you know, you shouldn't hesitate to go right after that and work in that area, in whether it's as an employee or as a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
But as an industry, that's what you like. You know, you might as well go for it if you're passionate
mm-hmm.
about.
Great. Thank you, Victor. We have someone who's raised their hand. I don't have a first name here, but it's cell phone from Chicago, Illinois, starting with the 312 area code 659. So you, Chicago, Illinois, you are live on the air right now.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. What's your name? My name's So. I'm actually
Hi.
A college student. I'm a senior
okay.
in college.
Uh-huh.
I go to Northwestern University, and
mm-hmm.
I thank you for the opportunity again because I really like listening to what you guys are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so my question is, you know, like what you guys said, I'm, you know, an avid student. I study economic. I'm not like 4.0, but I'm doing okay. And
mm-hmm.
right now I'm a senior, I'm looking for a job, and I sort of have two options. One
mm-hmm.
is going to the corporate analytical role, you know, and hopefully learn some Excel skills and, you know, climb up the corporate ladder and then get an MBA. And another road is that there's this opportunity that I got into where it's sales position. So at first I was like, oh, sales, really, you know, not as glamorous, mm-hmm. not what I paid, you know, 4 years of college to do. But as I learned more about the role, there's definitely a learning curve in the beginning where you learn a lot of the hardcore sales skills. But when you come out, you can be financially independent and you have a lot more freedom with your time, and you can actually have a better opportunity to own your own career path and own your own offices. And you know, it's definitely not a normal route that my mm-hmm. friends and my colleagues go into, but I just want to know what your thoughts on that is, because coming from an immigrant family, mm-hmm. My parents, you know, they really want me to go that traditional mm-hmm. route. So I just want to know what you guys' opinions are.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but Victor, why don't you, I'm sure you have some opinions on that.
I do, and I'll tie in some of the points you've mentioned. I think so let me try to answer the question in a way that it's applicable to everyone on the call, not just your particular case, although it will still be irrelevant.
Sure.
I think two things you need to do. One's a mindset thing and one's an activity. One is you need to determine what your goal is. So mm-hmm. your goal 3, 4, 5 years from now, what is that objective? And what do you need to accomplish between now and then in order to meet that objective? And you can evaluate the different career paths based on that. So if having the most money is one goal, then you look at which one has the higher chance of that kind of prospect. If learning certain skills is a particular goal and to your ultimate objective, then you figure out which opportunity has a better chance of learning those particular skills. So that's sort of the first thing I think everyone should be doing, and unfortunately not enough people do. The second one is more of a mindset shift, which is to think about your first couple of jobs coming out of school, and this is where I think, in some respects, I made a mistake. There's really only two. Most people come out of school thinking that they're going to work for somebody else, and even if you end up being an employee of someone else, I think the mindset you should have is you're the CEO of yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And that you're essentially the reason to have a job is not for the paycheck; it's to learn skills on someone else's expense. And it's hugely valuable because you can earn a living, you can pay for your living expenses, you can learn the kind of things you hopefully want to learn and make some money at it. And what happens is early you can screw up when someone else pays the expenses. And that's very useful. The second thing I would say is that you are also not just the CEO of yourself, but you're the chief investment officer of yourself. And this is not something I did, and I wish I did in hindsight because I very much regret it. But on day one, the only reason to work for someone else is to build up some capital to invest in yourself, whether that's literally a financial investment such as an MBA or stocks or bonds, or, Michael, something you and I share a lot together is investing in your own skills. Mm-hmm. Thinking of yourself as an investor is a really useful mindset that very few people, I don't think anyone ever thinks about. And I screwed that up. I mean, I had a friend who this was pretty sad. And actually, Michael speaks to your point about self-made success. I had a colleague who started with me at McKinsey. He bought an apartment in New York City at the time for it was a studio for like $85,000. They go for like $700,000 now. And 2 years later, he sold it and he made more money than my cumulative income, you know, over the 3 years I was in New York. And so he, in one decision, you know, he made more money than me working 800-hour weeks for 3 years in a row. That's 6,000 hours of work, and the income was the same, right? And I had enough money to buy a place. I just didn't know how to do it. Didn't occur to me to think like an investor, you know. And those properties today are worth close to $1 million, and he bought it for under 100. I'm like, geez, I just totally missed it. So I would challenge you in your case. What is your objective? And then what's the best way to meet that objective? And most of all, if you're having difficulty deciding, it generally means your objective is unclear. And I encourage you to think more about the objective and less about the particular options.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Thank you.
And then just on the immigrant path, because my parents were immigrants as well. This is worthy of a whole day seminar. If you're gonna deviate from your parents' expectations, which I ultimately did, there will be flack, and you just have to decide at some point whose life are you living. And I know people who have lived someone else's life till they're 50 and they're unhappy and they finally make a move. And those who break, and you know, it's a little hard in the beginning, but if it's what you're good at and you have a personal competitive advantage in the area you're trying to go in, and it's something you're very excited by, you're going to be more successful doing something you're good at and you like than trying to be very poor at something that you don't like but is considered more prestigious. I have a sort of extended family member who is a Columbia grad, computer science, forced to go into computer science because it's prestigious, you know, but had poor grades in that, hated it, never worked a day in it, wasn't good at it, and was really just a waste of time. Should have picked something else that she was good at. Michael, your
thoughts?
You. If you want to add anything?
You know, I think I could probably add some stuff, but I actually think you answered that wonderfully, Victor, and I think you nailed it there. So why don't we take them? There's so many questions here. Why don't we take a few more? Thank
Great.
You so much there, and I will.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I'll put that back on mute. Star 2, if you have any questions on the phone, we have a bunch of questions. I think far more people are listening in through the webcast. Here's a really interesting one. This is from Ale. How can you coach your boss without upsetting him? Oh, I like that question a lot. I really pride myself on coaching people who are more powerful than me. And that may sound like a weird thing to say, like, well, how do you coach someone who's more powerful than you? If they're more powerful, shouldn't they be coaching you? Well, yes, they are coaching you on certain areas or many areas that they are more powerful in. But everyone has areas that they're not as powerful in, and oftentimes those areas are holding them back. And if that without upsetting him is a really important part of that question, you have to be very sensitive around this. If the person is a first-rate leader, my experience is usually if it's brought up in a tactful way, they will be interested in how in perspectives on how they can do their job better. I mean, they are a leader. You are being led by them. It is actually possible to coach someone on how, give them feedback on how they're leading, just like you could give someone feedback on how they're leading you in a partner dance while they're leading you. Now, it has to be done extremely, extremely tactfully. Speaking of street smart education, there's a concept called social intelligence, which everyone on this call should know about. And there's a book called Social Intelligence by Daniel Goleman. And it's a number of factors around being intelligent in creating positive outcomes when you interact with people. And there's been studied a lot. There's a lot of evidence, hard evidence, that it's highly, highly correlated to your success in life, in some instances more so than academic intelligence. So this is an area for social intelligence, tact, you know, being gentle. I'll give some specifics because I do this a lot. The first thing I'm always doing, and I already mentioned this on the call, is I'm always inquiring, like, what people care about. If you know, so the word influence has a really nasty kind of Machiavellian term, but I actually think it's a really positive term. If I know what someone cares about, I can influence them quite a bit because I just talk about things they care about and say, hey, you know, I know you care about X. I know you care about revenue growth. You know, I think, have you ever considered that such and such might be a relevant way to start adding some more revenue? If you know that for a fact that they care about that, you can have a lot of influence with them talking about that thing they care about. So it always starts with knowing what your boss cares about. And here's a little tip, and you know, it may be slightly un-PC, but I think it's true. You know, we tend to have, you know, in corporate mission statements and corporate speak, there's a lot of talk. You know, everyone here is to, our mission is to enhance, you know, shareholder value and put forward these values in the company and all those kind of things. And, you know, all of that, people do care about those things. But most people also have more personal agendas within their career that you know, they have some office politics thing, someone that they're, you know, someone they're jockeying for with leadership, some department that they want to get more, you know, a reign over. And if you just start having frank conversations, and oftentimes they care about those things very, very passionately, more so than the kind of bland stuff that's on the corporate.
Totally, totally.
Yeah, and so if you can really get in their head and just ask them, like, well, what, you know, what are you, like, what's going on with that squabble you're having with so-and-so? Like, what are you trying to get out of this situation? And you ask that in a respectful way and find out what they want. you can coach them. You can say, you know, I know what this is. You want this thing. I know you want why. And would you be curious to hear my thoughts on how you can actually get, you know, closer to achieving why? I mean, if they're a good leader and they really care about what they care about, they're gonna be curious about it. Do you have any thoughts on that, Victor?
Yeah, a couple sort of nuanced points I'll add to that. The key thing, and I can't emphasize this enough, is to get them to share with you what their objective is. From a practical standpoint, it's actually easier to do that outside the office than in.
Yes.
So take your boss to lunch or a cup of coffee or just whatever, invent an excuse. And for whatever reason, there's a more relaxed kind of culture outside the office, even if it's with a coworker, where you can talk more about the personal stuff, and it's kind of considered rude not to at least talk about it, right? So you can ask that question; it wouldn't be perceived as you know, sticking your nose where it doesn't belong. So one is to understand what their goal is, and then the phrasing I often use, and I do this with both clients as well as partners and managing directors when I was an analyst, is, you know, hey, I noticed something that I think could be helpful in you achieving the goal you just told me about yesterday, or I see an obstacle that might be getting in the way of you achieving the goal you wanted to talk about that you talked about yesterday. You know, would you, and ask for permission. Would you be interested in learning about that some more? And so the key thing, particularly with senior level folks, is, and this is, you know, people talk about having good tact and being diplomatic, and I talk about that a lot. Here's how to do it: is C-level people, managers, bosses, people with more formal authority than you. You never want to challenge their authority, and you never want to challenge their ego. And so you have to be deferential in your respect towards them by allowing them to be in control or to be perceived to be in control. But you can introduce the topic by asking them if it's okay. See, by asking them if it's okay, you're being deferential because it's they're in charge, but you can still have the conversation. So that's sort of the way to do it, is ask what their objective is, preferably in a social setting, ask if they're interested in getting some another opinion on some things that could help them. And then once they give you permission, you know, then as long as you do so in a respectful way, and sometimes I'll frame it very gently, you might consider, or I noticed some people in the office thought, you know, when you yell at people, it seems that they're very unhappy with that. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just telling you what I've noticed, right, which is basically code for stop being an asshole, right? But you don't say stop being an asshole because then you're challenging their authority, and that's bad. So you always have to be deferential to the respect hierarchy, but you can still get your point across by harnessing that relationship in that way without challenging it.
That's great, Victor. We're gonna wind down now. We're at 90 minutes now. I want to take one more really interesting question, and then we'll wind down. And this is a text question from Bill in Toronto. How do you figure out what you're good at? It seems you, Michael, found out what you're good at by chance. Is there a systematic way? I have a very specific answer to that, and that is that for the most part, the things that we're going to end up good at are the things that we really enjoy learning about. So I think there's this kind of myth that people just have natural talent, and you know they're just born with a talent and they just do it. And if that were true, you know, basketball stars wouldn't practice, and you know, classical violinists wouldn't practice. And there's actually been quite a bit written about this now. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a lot about it in his most in Outliers, the importance of practice and learning. So my view is that, and this is my own view, there may be others out there, is that if you notice what you just are naturally drawn to learning that is somehow conceivably related to career. So if you're naturally drawn to learning about, you know, World War II reenactments, you know, it might be hard to think about how that would be related to career. I noticed I couldn't keep away from learning about the publishing industry. I mean, I don't know why, because, you know, a lot of people say books are dying, and I think there's certainly true about printed books, is there's an expiration date on how much printed books are going to be around. But I'm just obsessed with them. I grew up reading. I grew up in a house with books. I love books, and I just wanted to learn everything there was about how to produce them, how to write them, how to sell them, how the industry works. And I just couldn't keep away, even when there wasn't money to be made from it. And it turns out that now I am making a good living in that area. So finding an area where you that's somehow related to possibly earning money and that you just can't keep away from learning. Does that correlate to your experience, Victor?
It does. I'll give you sort of two other options too. One is there's a whole body of material out there around figuring out what you're good at. There's one book in particular that comes to mind. It's called Strengths Finder 2.0, and essentially it's a self-assessment determining what skills you're good at, and it's very useful to figure that out. The second is what you will ultimately be good at in your career, you probably have already demonstrated interest and experience in your past. So, I mean, I went to an executive coach to help me figure out what I was good at, and he was really smart. He just sort of surveyed people from the last 20, 30 years of my life, you know, so from friends from high school, people I knew in college, coworkers, and it was interesting that, you know, the question he asked everyone was, you know, what is Victor's gift and or unique talent? And what was interesting, and apparently this is true for every time he's done this, is all the answers were consistent. And the only person who was surprised by the answer was me.
Yeah.
So they all said this, you know, he's really good at, like, zeroing in on, like, the most important thing and, you know, kind of cutting through all the noise and finding the most important thing. And basically another version of this, take something complicated and figure out the heart of it, make it very simple.
Yeah.
And I guess it's been true since high school, and I had no idea. Because, like, your reaction, when you're gifted at something, by the way, I should mention, you don't realize you're gifted because you just sort of take for granted that, well, it's always been true. So, Michael, you've always been interested in publishing. I mean, isn't everybody interested in publishing?
Yeah.
And so you don't realize that until later on that, no, not everyone's interested in publishing.
Yeah.
So that's the other trope, ask people around you.
Yeah. It's a great point. So, Victor, thank you so much for taking the time to allow me to share some of my perspective with your amazing audience. We had hundreds of people on the call today through webcast and calling. I want to close actually with one question for you. Is you're one of the only, really probably the only other person on this call who has read my book. Why might you think that someone, you know, might get value out of this, given you know who's on the call? You know, what kind of people would get value? What would they be looking for if that was a good match for them?
I'll tell you, there is a very strong culture in consulting, which I agree half with and disagree with on the other half. And I think it's useful to see how the other half lives, if you would. So if you're extremely book smart, make it your purpose to learn from people who are street smart to see what the alternative point of view is. And you get a much more balanced perspective. And so I think for anyone who is early in their career or making a career transition, it is useful to see a broader range of what is possible. And so that gives you context for making a better choice than where you are today. The other thing I think it's useful for is I don't think people plan their careers far enough ahead, in some cases because they don't know enough about themselves, which is part of being particularly younger. And for those that so I would encourage people to have greater vision and to think broadly, and getting a sense of, again, what others have done is very useful in planning your career. And more specifically, there are I think the premise of the book I like a lot and think it's something that people really should sort of adopt around, you know, you're learning, now that you've finished school, your learning now begins.
Yeah.
And as evidence of that, I mean, I was, I moved about a year ago, and so I had to weigh everything that we own.
Yeah.
And we moved 18,000 pounds, which was a shock to me. But and about 8,000 of it was my books.
Yeah.
So I had literally 100 boxes of books. At one point in my career, I was buying a new bookshelf every 90 days.
Yeah.
And I got to the point where I consumed my office with bookshelves. I lined the halls with it with bookshelves. And my wife said, Victor, if you're going to buy any more books, you know, you need to buy us a bigger house because you can't have every room in the house be yours.
Yeah.
And you've already taken two of them. And for my birthday, for Christmas 1 year, she gave me a Kindle, which is great.
Yeah.
I could keep buying it. It was perfect.
Yeah.
So this idea of continuing to learn is really important. And I think there are three areas in particular in your book that I think will be very relevant to the management consultant, the aspiring management consultant. I think you referenced six skills that the street smart people have, seven skills rather. And there's three in particular that I would point out. One was what you call success skill number two, which is around finding mentors through networking. Lots of great material there. Some people have sort of seen a preview of that in some of the videos you've done. Skills area number four, which is about sales. And there's a great section in there. I totally forgot you had recorded this. When I was advising Jenna, your wife, at the time, I guess, girlfriend back then.
Yeah.
You asked about sales, and you thought it was, like, icky and kind of disgusting because it's kind of sleazy. And I said, well, here's another way to sell. Let me demonstrate. And I think you'll recall, I basically started to sell Jenna's business to someone pretending to be a customer. And so she pretended to be the customer. I pretended to be her. And I sold her and didn't see – and she felt like it was very high integrity, very high not sleazy at all. And I didn't actually say anything. I just asked a couple questions.
I remember this moment so clearly, and it was three years ago or so. And this moment, everyone on the call, just changed my life. I was a freelancer. My money was not as good as it is now, largely because I didn't know how to sell, and I was scared of it, and I thought it was sleazy and icky, and it's what used car salespeople do. And so I had a lot of negative attitudes around it. And Victor, you know, instead of just, it's like what we've been talking about, doing versus saying, instead of trying to convince me or persuade me with words and how I'm wrong, he just started selling Jenna, my wife, on her own business. I mean, her business is weight loss coaching. You know, I'm not aware that Victor has any special expertise on weight loss coaching the way my wife does, but he just started selling her on weight loss coaching. And he wasn't talking about, you know, you just got to read the book. There's a whole transcript in there that is really cool.
I was particularly on that day, and she was particularly good at being hard on me in terms of throwing the objections and all that. So it worked out pretty well. So I'm glad you recorded it because I don't think I could duplicate it.
It blew my mind, and just seeing how it's done well can totally reframe you about that. So Victor, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. It's really been wonderful, and thank you everyone on the call. And we've still got, you know, a couple hundred people on there, so I assume that means that that we provided some value. And thank you so much, everyone out there, for your attention and time.
Great. And, Michael, thank you for making the time to talk to all of us. And once again, for everyone who's on the call, Michael's book is The Education of Millionaires. It's available for pre-order in all the major bookstores and online booksellers. I know Amazon.com has it. Even though you sent me a hard copy, I actually pre-ordered the Kindle one.
Oh,
so I like to keep the hardcover as my collector's item.
Okay,
and I like
perfect.
The Kindle to actually read.
I'll send you a book plate so it's signed too.
Cool. Well, appreciate
all
that.
All right. So, thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody.
Out there. Okay. All right. Bye.
All right,